This is Sovereign Canada. I'm Mike McCullough, broadcasting on CIVL, syndicated on campus and community radio stations across the country, and recorded on the shared, unceded, and traditional territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. Today on the show, Never 51. You'll hear from a bar owner who isn't stopping showing his Canadian pride, even after vandals tore down part of a flag professing Canadian sovereignty.
We are completely against the idea of the Trump that he joined the U.S.
Nasser Nabahat from the Ivanhoe Hotel in Vancouver says he wants to see Canadians out on the street for a day of solidarity against Trump. Then Sovereign Canada goes poli-sci. First, you'll hear from Dr. Maria Popova, an associate professor of political science at McGill University, who highlights some of the ways in which Trump is an awful lot like his little buddy Vladimir Putin.
They're really worrying parallels, indeed, that are becoming clearer every day, unfortunately.
Then you'll hear from Dr. Stuart Prest, a political science lecturer at the University of British Columbia. He offers his insights into what Canada can do to weather the storm.
Canada could find ways to galvanize those countries that are aware of the threat, creating some version of an economic NATO.
Plus, I'll recap Prime Minister Mark Carney's first official foreign and domestic trips. A high-ranking Canadian diplomat says Trump's threats are about stealing Canadian land and resources, and I'll talk about the Canadian woman home after 2 weeks after being locked up by ICE. All of that ahead on this edition of Sovereign Canada. And thanks so much for joining me. I have a great episode planned for you today. But first, we'll look at some of the recent news as it relates to this ongoing fight for Canadian sovereignty. Starting with the top office of the land, as Canada's new Prime Minister Mark Carney made his first overseas trip to France and then to the United Kingdom, which is a break from tradition as Canadian prime ministers usually visit Washington, D.C. for their first foreign trip. In France, alongside French President Emmanuel Macron, Prime Minister Carney reiterated that Canada is strong and expressed Canada's continued commitment to Ukraine and said, quote, "With you, Mr. President, I want to ensure that France and the whole of Europe works enthusiastically with Canada, the most European of non-European countries, determined, like you, to maintain the most positive possible relations with the United States," end quote. Later on in the United Kingdom, Carney met with UK Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer, as well as King Charles III. Speaking with reporters in London, Carney said US President Donald Trump has to stop threatening Canadian sovereignty before he'd be willing to meet with his counterpart in the White House, saying, quote, "We've called out those comments. They're disrespectful, they're not helpful, and they need to stop. And they will have to stop before we sit down and have a conversation about our broader partnership with the United States," end quote. Reporters also wanted Carney to discuss what assurances to Canadian security that his counterparts in the UK and France may have made to him. And Carney said, quote, "We don't need another country to validate our sovereignty. We are sovereign. We don't need praise from another country. We are proud in and of ourselves." Continuing, Carney said, quote, "I would point out that the Prime Minister," that's Starmer, "made a point of referring to our sovereignty, made a point of referring to our shared sovereign in King Charles III, and that, quote, Canada can stand up for ourselves. It's Canada strong," end quote. In his remarks, Carney referred to the shared history of Canada with its founders from the UK and from France, which, if you recall back to Carney's first speech as Prime Minister, he said that Canada is, quote, "a country built on the bedrock of three peoples, Indigenous, French, and British." So it tracks then that Carney wrapped up his overseas trip with a return to Canada by making his first domestic visit, meeting with the Premier of Nunavut with a stop in Iqaluit. Carney also again alluded to that symbolism to Canada's founding, but also in a press release from the PMO, and there at his speech, Carney said that the visit was to reaffirm Canadian sovereignty by strengthening our military, bolstering our Arctic security, and unleashing the North's economic potential. The Prime Minister also spoke of a $6 billion NORAD modernization plan, which includes a partnership with Australia to develop modern radar systems meant to detect air and marine threats over the Arctic faster and from farther away. Carney also highlighted a nearly $420 million funding package allotted to the Canadian Armed Forces forces to expand operations in the Arctic, and Carney touched on a federal government investment of more than $250 million for housing and for infrastructure across Nunavut, which the PMO bills as an effort to advance reconciliation with First Nations, Inuit, and Métis peoples. Carney said, quote, "The world is changing. Our adversaries are increasingly emboldened. International institutions and norms that have kept Canada secure are now being called into question," end quote. Carney highlighted that the United States' priorities are shifting and also said, quote, "We cannot and should not look to others to defend our nation," end quote. And yeah, it's a pretty big deal strategically that the PM would visit the Arctic as his first trip, because this is a region that a high-ranking Canadian ambassador thinks is the center of Trump's designs on Canada. Canada's ambassador and permanent representative to the United Nations, Bob Rae, putting it really in no uncertain terms, writing in a series of posts on Elon Musk's social media site, formerly called Twitter, to offer his analysis of what Trump's threats against Canadian sovereignty are all about. The former interim leader of the Liberal Party of Canada and NDP Premier of Ontario posted a map of the Arctic Circle and wrote, quote, "This map might help explain what it is President Trump is talking about. By annexing Canada and Greenland, the United States would simultaneously seize massive wealth and control both the Northwest Passage and surrounding waters. You need to see the Arctic Ocean at the center," end quote. Rae would further add in another message, quote, tweeting the original about a half an hour later, that, quote, "To emphasize, this is not about borders or fentanyl. This is about a colossal land, water, and resource grab. The tariffs are intended to weaken so this theft can take place. We're not talking purchase or buying. We're talking theft by force. Fighting back will be hard, but it will be the fight of our lives," end quote. Ambassador Bob Rae. Yeah, he puts it in really no uncertain terms. This is about Trump trying to take us over by force. I reached out to Global Affairs for comment from the ambassador, and a spokesperson declined my request, but I suspect Ambassador Bob Rae is pretty busy. In other news, Jasmine Mooney, the Vancouver woman who was detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers and held in the United States immigration system for 2 weeks, has now been freed. Mooney penned an article in The Guardian, which I highly recommend you read. The actress and entrepreneur describes the horrendous conditions that she was held in, transferred repeatedly, including a facility in San Diego, where she was originally held, then to Arizona, back to San Diego before finally being released. She describes the many women that she met while in detention, many of whom admitted, yeah, at times they had overstayed visas, sometimes only for a couple of days, and then were later arrested and held in these horrendous conditions, some of them for months. Mooney concludes that the ICE detention centers are not, quote, "just a bureaucratic nightmare. It's a business. These facilities are privately owned and run for profit. The more detainees, the more money they make. It stands to reason that these companies have no incentive to release people quickly," end quote. Yeah, check out the full article. It's an incredible story and really incredibly harrowing. And she says in the article that she feels lucky that she got out as quickly as she did. She had a lot of support from the outside, which is something that many of the women who were trapped in there simply just don't have. I have offered Mooney an opportunity to comment, but I've not heard back. I suspect she's being inundated with requests from other media around the country, so it's quite understandable. And finally, I want to highlight the Ivanhoe Hotel in Vancouver. Earlier this month, the owner of the Ivanhoe, Nasser Nabahat, put up a Canadian flag with the words "Never 51 emblazoned on it. The flag was then vandalized, with the bottom portion of it torn away. Undeterred, Nabahat grabbed a paintbrush, some white paint, and climbed up to make that message permanent, painting 51st onto the wall and leaving the upper portion of the flag intact. I was able to catch up with Nabahat as well as his employee, and here's that interview now.
My name is Nasser Nabahat, and I am the owner-operator of Ivanhoe Pub and Ivanhoe Hotel.
Right on. And you are, sir?
David Potter.
David Potter, and you work here at the...
I'm a staff member at the hotel.
We didn't look for public,
publicity.
Yeah, publicity. We were just looking for send a message to our neighborhood, and we were, had a huge positive response from our neighborhood here. And next day, we just, someone cut it in half, which really... went on my nerve, actually. And it was raining. I went to Home Depot. I bought paint, oil paint, went up myself, and I wrote 50 first myself. That stays there, nobody can peel it out. And at the same time, I have to criticize our media in BC that they should push for huge gathering of people on the street saying that we are against. Because if you don't do that, our south neighbor, they think that we are really agreeing what they are saying. And we need, as a people, to go out on the street and just say, no, we don't want.
Yeah, that's all about living in a free society, right? Standing up and using your voice.
Yeah. And one of the things that really upset me that by someone vandalizing my sign, showing to me that even in my own country I can express my opinion or my patriotism about my own country. That was the main issue that really bothered me on top of everything.
Yeah, and so the response has been pretty positive though overall, right, since?
It is, yeah, actually, in our Facebook, we have hundreds of people, they responded and they were supporting us. Even from Alberta, I hear that people sending message through Facebook and supporting our actions here in BC.
Right on. And this sign now is here to stay, never 51st.
It's going to stay. Actually, I ordered more flags, which is says on the flags, Canada is not for sale. And it's coming up in next week or so. I think we are receiving them next week, and I'm going to put them on.
And you're from Iran originally, isn't that right?
I come from Iran, yeah. Lived in Canada since 1983. When I came here, I was like 20 years old. Canada is a good country, and people that they live in, that were born in Canada, they don't realize what jewel they have, the diamond they have in their hands. You know, and they just used to for everything. And we should really go to the idea that we can lose that and get together and fight against it.
What is your opinion on what's been going on at the grocery stores, people not buying American goods and all that?
Fantastic. Actually, if you go to my bar and we have put the sign on the Budweiser tab, saying that don't dare to ask. So just a small
that's awesome. Nasser, is there anything I haven't thought to ask that you'd like to add? I know you're in a hurry.
I'm in a hurry, but as I said, I'm just looking forward that we have a huge demonstration here in BC. Everybody participates and show their support for Canada and not for being the 51st state of U.S.
Anything you wanted to throw in there, David?
Nasser pretty much said it, but he didn't mention what he said last time, and that is that people have to realize that Trump is very, very serious. He wants the world. He would buy. He will take the world if he can't buy it.
Yeah.
That's all.
So if we send the message now, maybe we can head him off, right?
Well, there are people sending message every day. It's getting growing in Canada all over the place, so... It is growing.
Right on. Thanks so much for your time, gentlemen. Have a great day.
Yeah, and I hope that we, nationwide, we organize one day.
Yeah.
It happens in Vancouver, happens in Toronto, happens every corner of the Canada, that the people go on the street and they say no to what our southern country wants to do.
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, a day of declaration of sovereignty against against Trump and those ideas.
There's a scoop in the news that just came out today that the Trump administration wants to designate fentanyl as a weapon of mass destruction. What do you think that's about?
This is all pressure and on Canada, and I mean these are all excuses from Trump against Canada. All these tariffs and economical pressure on Canada, it's all has a purpose, and the purpose is that he wants to weaken Canada as much as he can, and then people willingly to go and says, okay, we are going to join the U.S. And that is all, in my opinion, is BS, what the Trump and Trump administration is saying. And as I said, please, I'm asking the media, try to organize whole country in one day. Everybody comes on the street from every corner of Canada, and we go against what our southern country is saying against us. And also protect and support our prime ministers, doesn't matter which party. I really hated that they insult our prime ministers and they call them governor. And that is also another thing that we really, really need to support our government, our part, our, it doesn't matter the conservative, NDP, liberals or whatever. This is insult to whole Canadian.
Yeah, I spoke with MP Charlie Angus, who's been really vocal about all this, and he keeps making the point that it's super important to send messages and symbols of solidarity like this. So I think both the thing that you did here with the flag and your message here about a day of solidarity are incredibly important and right on point. So I just want to say thank you.
Exactly. I hope that that happens soon, and we should not just wait, see what's happening. And I think we should send this message. I want that the whole world, they see that too. You know, and whole world they see Canada as a mute for what's happening against in Canada, and we should not show the U.S. and show the whole world no, we are against it. We don't want it.
That was Nasser Nabahat along with his employee David Potter from the Ivanhoe Hotel and Pub on Main Street in Vancouver, and yeah, just a little geeky reporter hat going on here to clarify the feedback loop of how the media usually works. You know, news reporters, news shows, they typically don't get out ahead of any specific story or cause and push for it. Typically, the order of operations is that, like, an individual in the public has an idea, they tell their friends, maybe their family, the idea organizes across the country to have this day of solidarity in this case, you know. Then you go to the media with this idea and you say, hey, we have this on this date, in this place, for this cause. And at that point, then the media will attach to your idea and say, a protest will be happening on date X, right? Usually that's how it goes. So, but in this case, I'll put it back to you. What do you think of Nasser's idea? If you're hearing this and maybe Nasser's inspired you to call for this day of action to show Trump, yeah, we're sovereign. We don't want any part of this. You know, get out there and work on this. Maybe don't realize how powerful you are, but we live in a free country and every voice counts for something. It's not just about voting in a democracy. Every single day is part of, you know, building this country. So get out there, organize. Nasser wants you to. And if you do, give me a call, let me know about it, because I'd love to hear about it. Okay, coming up after the break, you're going to hear from my conversation with UBC political science lecturer Dr. Stuart Prest, who argues that Canada needs to build a coalition of the unwilling to take on the U.S. But first, you'll hear from Dr. Maria Popova, who makes the compelling case that Trump is essentially a taller, fatter Vladimir Putin. Stick around. As U.S. President Donald Trump continues to threaten Canadian sovereignty, many have noticed the distinctly Putin-esque nature of his language. One of those people is Associate Professor of Political Science at McGill University and Scientific Director of the Jean Monnet Center in Montreal. That's Dr. Maria Popova. Thank you so much for joining me on Sovereign Canada.
Thanks for having me.
Can we just first touch on some of this Putin-esque language? You're an expert in some of this Eastern European affairs, so I wonder if you can sort of break down how Trump is very closely mirroring Putin.
There's a whole host of similarities, unfortunately, and there's more and more similarities coming out. But first, it all started with this idea that it is somehow in Canada's interest to join the bigger neighbor, the US. And that's something that also Russia, beyond Putin, had as a narrative way before the war started. This idea that Russia and Ukraine belong together, that it's an artificial border, that they're brotherly people, that they're very close in culture, in identity, that the differences are superficial, not real. So all of this, and also the condescension towards the little brother from the bigger brother, there is a lot of things that are echoing this way earlier than 22 or even 2014 when Russia first attacks Ukraine. And of course, we as Canadians, we're familiar with that sort of joking condescension. Of course, that's been around for a very long time as well. But where things are really, I think, escalating is when, for example, Putin in 2021 wrote a long essay where he basically said that there is no such thing as Ukraine. It's an artificial nation and an artificial country. And in fact, there is a unity of Russian and Ukrainian people, and therefore they need to be together in the same state. And this is what also is the new thing that we're seeing coming from the Trump administration, because, I mean, previously we had not heard this really from the US. And even in the first, in his first term, Trump was not saying things like that, which is, I think, one of the reasons why it seems that this is somehow inspired by Russia's invasion of Ukraine, because there is this example of Putin who already acted on these ideas of artificial border, artificial state, also the idea that somehow the only way to guarantee the sovereignty of Canada is by being part of the US, which is, of course, an oxymoron. But it's an oxymoron that Putin has straight up said the exact same thing. He has straight up said that the only guarantor of Ukraine's independence and sovereignty is Russia, when in fact, Russia is the only threat to Ukraine's sovereignty and independence. So they're really worrying parallels indeed that are becoming clearer every day, unfortunately.
And most recently, it really seems to me, I'm hearing a lot more what reminds me of the lead up to the U.S. invasion of the Iraq area, and you know, the sort of constant drumbeat, not just from Trump but also in the media as well, with the surrogates. Have you been hearing some of this, and what do you make of that?
Yeah, there is the sort of looking for a pretext, right, to say we absolutely need to invade, take over because of XYZ, and indeed in the Russia-Ukraine case, the pretext was this so-called narrative of denazification that Russia tried to push in the beginning of the 22 invasion, where they basically claimed very absurdly that the Ukrainian government is a Nazi government and is dominating Ukrainian society, so it has to be removed. And this is something, so that was the pretext, right? We need to remove this Nazi government. The Trump administration hasn't started saying things along those lines yet about Canada. I mean, I can imagine that the equivalent for Canada would be something like, You have a government that's not legitimate. It's infected by a woke virus or whatever, right? That's what Musk talks about. And therefore, you need to be invaded and rid. We need to basically free regular Canadians, so to speak, from this bad government. I mean, there are some, I've heard here and there some suggestions to that effect. But it has indeed become much more hostile. And another parallel that I see is in the Russian case, they're very, it's a very common thread to ask and to claim that the nations that they're threatening or oppressing need to be grateful. This narrative of gratitude is very, very predominant in the way that Russia related to the weaker states around it. And suddenly we are hearing that narrative of gratitude from the US. As the US is attacking us in this trade war, they're saying that we need to be grateful to be the US's neighbor. And we need, in fact, to be grateful that we're being offered to be annexed. We need to be grateful for the offer of annexation. That's the latest.
Do you think that, like, I don't even really want to contemplate, like, the game out of what would happen, like, but I don't really think anybody believes we would be granted true, you know, citizenship or statehood within a state. I think we would be some territory and you know, basically propertyless and voteless people.
Right. I mean, of course, the difference I think there between the Russia, Ukraine and US Canada parallel is that the Ukrainians knew very well that if they're taken over, they're being taken over by a dictatorship in which nobody has any rights. And that's one of the reasons why they've been fighting so with such determination, because they would like to continue living in their democratic state and not be taken over by a highly repressive dictatorship. Now, in our case, it's trickier to think through this, because so far the U.S. is still a democracy where elections take place, and people have rights so far. But you're right. Would Canada be offered that kind of status, or would it be sort of put in a transitional period in which it has no rights, and or would it be? I've seen some people speculate that, you know, maybe the idea is to give Canada a status similar to Puerto Rico or Washington, D.C., which does not have representation. Of course, the difference is huge in terms of population, but it will probably. Chances are it implies disenfranchisement of Canadians, yeah.
I think the one thing, I'm going to go out on a limb and predict that one thing Trump and his posse may try to use to do, as you were saying in the previous answer, around try to delegitimize our government. He may seize on the fact that Mark Carney is not a sitting MP, and he's an unelected, you know, I can just imagine it already, you know?
Absolutely. And it would be, again, a perfect analogy to these claims that Russia is now trying to push that Zelensky is somehow not legitimate anymore because elections are suspended because Russia is invading Ukraine and you cannot have elections while you're being invaded. So they're trying to spin this as a legitimacy deficit for Zelensky. And yeah, I could also see some arguments and legal gymnastics being used to claim that our government is somehow illegitimate, and obviously conspiracies about deep state and whatnot. I mean, I think at this point, this in this post-truth era, it's very easy to come up with all sorts of really thin claims, fact-wise, and poorly stitched together theories, but then they can echo with people.
So what do we do going forward, first internationally? How do we strengthen our sovereignty on the international stage? What would you suggest that we could do?
I think it's really important for Canada to be intensifying, strengthening, widening ties with Europe, because right now, Europe is really spooked, obviously, by the Trump administration's behavior vis-a-vis Ukraine and this reset with Russia that is coming. The statements by multiple Trump administration officials that the U.S. will no longer be the big guarantor of European security. And so Europeans are really thinking and stepping up big time in terms of bolstering their security with more defense spending. So in addition to security, the EU, of course, is a huge trading bloc. And it's a club of democracies that play by the rules and are very careful with the rules and determine them by consensus. So I think given that that's a huge market and, you know, bigger than the American market in terms of sheer number of people, obviously farther for us, but we have to be exploring how to strengthen our trade and security ties with Europe in order to be able to push back and hopefully have some diplomatic chance at stopping or reversing what now looks like an emerging Russo-American alliance, because a Russo-American alliance is really dangerous to both us and Europe.
Yeah, and it signals something darker occurring in the United States, to go back to your foreshadowing word choice yet when talking about the United States has elections or still has elections and still have people there still have rights, you know?
Yeah, it is very worrisome, because you have to think, you know, how can an established, long-standing democracy and sort of, you know, the supposed leader of the free world that the U.S. styled itself to be for so long, why are we seeing a U.S. administration being so focused on resetting to a friendly relationship with an aggressive, repressive dictatorship? Why is this necessary? Now, of course, it's not necessary. What needs to be done is the U.S. needs to help Europe contain Russian aggression. I mean, it's so obvious that that's in the interest of democracies. And the argument that somehow by trying to have a friendlier relationship with Russia, the U.S. administration is now weakening China, is a really, really weak argument. It's a weak argument because Russia is just not strong enough and not important enough to be any help to China. If anything, Russia is sort of draining resources from China as a junior partner in that relationship. So if we're concerned about China, then it's no benefit whatsoever to have this drain on Chinese resources being decoupled from them. So I think that argument absolutely doesn't fly. And so it makes it clear that the reason the US administration is pursuing this policy of friendly relations with Russia has nothing to do with China, really, but it has to do with the fact that President Trump seems to admire Putin as a role model. And that's why he wants a friendly relationship with him.
And so what can we do internally, politically, to sort of shield ourselves from this, to sort of ward this off?
Yeah, that's a very, very important question, because if we use the Ukrainian example here, what that suggests is, because in Ukraine, in the run-up to the first Russian invasion, which was 2014, there were a lot of people who felt a close cultural affinity with Russia. They watched Russian TV. They consumed Russian cultural outputs, you know, listening to Russian music. I mean, President Zelensky himself was a star in Russia. Not just in Ukraine, but also in Russia. So you can think of him, you know, as, I don't know, Jim Carrey, or one of the many Canadian stars that we have in Hollywood. That was him. He was a Ukrainian star in Moscow. So there was a very strong cultural affinity and enmeshment between the two countries. And that continued even after Russia first attacked Ukraine in 2014. But at that point, people started realizing that there probably needs to be some work to try to actually disentangle people from the narratives of the aggressor, basically. And what Ukraine did is they started a lot of civil society initiatives and non-governmental organizations that popped up to basically counter some of the Russian narratives that were targeting Ukrainian society, to counter some of the disinformation that was coming from Russia towards Ukrainian consumers. And that was actually very effective. There's research that shows that after 2014, Ukrainians simply abandoned, for example, Russian social media networks. They simply closed their accounts. And it wasn't a government policy. It was based on a grassroots effort to counter this source of disinformation. Now, the U.S. is not sending necessarily disinformation our way right now, in the sense that right now this talk about annexation is kind of limited to the Trump administration. But I can imagine that if this goes further, and I mean, I've already seen some, I don't know, Fox News hosts talking, you know, basically spreading this idea that Canada needs to be annexed, right? I mean, I think there was an interview that Doug Ford did on Fox News, and the anchor asked him whether he was flattered that by the offer of annexation. So if that kind of talk intensifies from American sources, from American cultural products, we're going to have to start thinking how, as a society, we can counter this, because some people are going to fall for it. Some people who dislike our government may think, well, maybe it's better for us to be taken over. So I think we're vulnerable, and it's something that we'll have to navigate as this goes forward. And we need to be careful and learning, I think, from the Ukrainians here.
What kind of a timeline do you think we're on?
It's really hard to say, because it depends on so many things. It depends on sort of the stability of the Trump administration, in addition to these geopolitical threats. The Trump administration is pursuing domestic policies that may very seriously destabilize America itself. And if there is some sort of counter reaction and Trump is basically immobilized politically, then, I mean, that's good for us. But I think right now we're facing the question of how can American institutions and American civil society curb this? Because I think ultimately it depends on them much more than on us. And sort of the Russian analogy here is that Russian society did not at all curb the Putin regime. If anything, after the takeover of Crimea in 2014, there was a massive outpouring of pride and happiness that Russia has annexed this territory. As a result, that, of course, was emboldening to the Putin regime. And of course, they went further because the societal context was extremely permissive of further adventures like this. Now, I don't know yet. I mean, so far, polls are showing that Americans think this is really, you know, a really dumb idea. They don't actually support taking over Canada, or they didn't even support renaming the Gulf of Mexico into the Gulf of America. I mean, they did not vote for this. I think that's quite clear. But who knows how things develop, you know? I think it's very, very hard to predict here. But what I do believe is that it will be up to American institutions and American civil society to stop this.
Were there some moments in Russia leading into the 2014 invasion into Crimea and the eastern Ukraine where there was some wagging of the dog, so to speak, where the government was able to sort of bring people on side? And do you foresee the Trump administration trying similar steps in that regard?
Yeah, I mean, the invasion of 2014 was extremely unexpected. That's why it was so covert, right? These little green men, even Russian society wasn't fully aware of what had just happened. And it was initially sold as this supposed referendum by Crimeans who supposedly voted themselves to join Russia. So the narrative was, it was just very covert and very misrepresented for everyone. I don't know that the US can do that. There's just a lot more freedom of speech and free institutions and diversified media and all that to do something like that in the US. But I think what's more likely and worrisome in the US trajectory might be sort of building up this idea that Canada is ungrateful, undeserving over time. And I think it is possible for people to come around to that idea that Canada is an enemy and not a friend. I mean, I think that's not so hard to sell something like that because, you know, especially if things, if the economy, you know, tanks and things are not doing well, can Canada be made the, you know, the, can they blame us? I mean, South Park's, you know, blame Canada. I mean, I think it's possible. Mm-hmm. I think it's possible to make us into the culprit. For whatever economic dysfunction follows. And then we're in a dangerous situation, for sure.
Dr. Maria Popova, where can people find you if they'd like to perhaps interact with you on social media or learn more?
Yeah, absolutely. I am on Blue Sky and a bit still on Twitter quite a lot. And they can check out my website, which is popovaprof.ca.
A special thank you to Dr. Maria Popova from McGill University for appearing on this show. And coming up right after the break, we'll continue Poli-Sci class, where Dr. Stuart Prest, a lecturer at UBC, tells us about how Canada can head this off with a little help from our friends. As U.S. President Donald Trump and his administration continue to threaten Canadian sovereignty, the daily calls to make Canada the 51st state have begun to take on a darker tone, including rhetoric that, to my untrained ear, sounds quite a bit like the drumbeat preceding George W. Bush's administration's invasion of Iraq in 2003. For this segment, we'll turn to a man who has recently written in Maclean's that while the U.S. continues to shred its own credibility on the international stage, with Trump trying to, quote, turn global diplomacy into a lawless extortion racket, that not only does Canada need to put up a united front internally, but around the world too, by forming a, quote, coalition of the unwilling. I'm pleased to welcome Stuart Prest, who holds a PhD in political science and a master's in international affairs, and is currently a lecturer in the Department of Political Science at UBC. Welcome, Dr. Prest.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
So first off, I wanted to ask you about how this 51st state rhetoric is really quickly ratcheting up into what sound like threats of invasion. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think it's certainly curious. If there was something we just did not expect as Canadians, it was that the threat to our country would be emanating from what we thought was our closest partner and ally. But we seem to be in a space where not only is the United States not acting as an ally or a friend of Canada, but its president seems to be bent on trying to threaten Canada in every way that it occurs to him to do. And we're having to respond to a threat we never anticipated in ways that we never anticipated as a result.
Yeah, this is a country that's been allied with us for almost our entire history. Of course, we do have some shared history that is not so close, of course, but for at least the last 80 years, the alliance has been strong and fruitful for the both of our nations. What do we do if the United States truly does switch sides and decides Canada is a threat, and I'm putting air quotes on that, and decides that, you know, they really do want to take this to the natural conclusion of what you expect when somebody says your sovereignty is invalid?
Yeah, I think we have to find ways to stand up for ourselves. There's a school of thought in international politics, realism, which is built around the idea that ultimately states have to depend on themselves for their own security. And we have gotten in the habit of relying on our alliance with the United States for our security. But now that the threat is, the calls are coming from within the House, we have to find ways to see to our own defense. And so that, I think, takes a number of different forms. We could never win an actual armed conflict with the United States, but we can do all kinds of things to make it clear that these kinds of threats and saber rattling is always only going to work out against the United States' advantage, and making it clear there's nothing to be gained and so much to be lost by this drumbeat of attacking. But at the same time, finding it ways to look for other support internationally as well. As you mentioned in the introduction, Canada is not alone here completely. We can and should be drawing on the support of other countries around the world.
And going back to your Maclean's piece, you write, quote, Canada must act now to galvanize other countries into standing together against his threats, that's Trump's threats, of economic coercion and territorial expansionism. So, like, what does a coalition of the unwilling look like? And were you intending to refer to the U.S. coalition of partners that were strong-armed by the U.S. into invading Iraq back in 2003?
Yeah, it's a bit of a reference, essentially saying we're unwilling to go along with the U.S. lead, and in contrast with those who went along with the U.S. lead at that period of time. But effectively, every country is going to be the worse for a world in which the United States is engaging a kind of economic coercion to what we say or else, this kind of extortive approach to global politics. That's in nobody's interests, including the United States. That's for reasons we were just discussing. They're going to lose credibility. They're going to lose these trust-based relationships they worked so hard to build. But other countries clearly are not going to benefit from the fear of being threatened by the United States anytime anything comes up. There were really uncomfortable conversations between Donald Trump and the I think it was the president of Ireland. Things like this about the fact that the United States might be coming for Ireland. Effectively, we see Ireland as a potential threat, like Ireland. Anybody could be subject to a different round of threatening language, aggressive language. And so there is an interest for just about every country in the world, other than, I guess, Russia, in finding a way to push back against this U.S. economic course of approach to politics. And so Canada could find ways to galvanize those countries that are aware of the threat, creating some version of an economic NATO, if you like, is another. That's how my dad described it when I tried to explain what I was talking about. But the sense that an economic act of coercion against one state is going to be a threat to other states who are going to be in line for similar treatment down the road. And so now is a moment where Canada can turn to these other states that are also facing or could be facing economic tariffs and threats. We see this extending to countries in Europe and countries in Latin America, and say, we should all work together to push back and say, if you target any one of these countries with a tariff, we are all going to collectively apply a reciprocal tariff. And we're not going to stop until effectively the United States turns it in a different direction. All the while also finding ways to help these countries diversify away from the American market, to look for ways to build resilience in the global economies for as long as the United States takes this course. The world can't replace the United States. It is a huge component of global politics and global economic the global economic order. But at the same time, there are ways to reduce exposure to that economy and to reduce the vulnerability to these asymmetrical threats that the United States keeps making. There is a vulnerability that the United States has to the rest of the world as well. And when you start looking at the combined role of Canada, Mexico, China, who is also threatened by these tariffs, countries of Europe, that is now tying in a significant portion of the U.S. economic global footprint. And so that is a considerable vulnerability for the United States. And if the other countries of the world that see value in moving towards a more rules-based approach to politics, and so China, we have to think about just how does it fit into that picture. It's clearly different than the countries of Latin America or Europe, but let's say these countries can collectively say, we're going to apply our own reciprocal tariff collectively against the United States as long as it is engaging in this course of that behavior. That can send a strong signal that this is not going to work. It is going to be to the dramatic disadvantage of American consumers. And then that will ultimately put pressure on the administration in ways that can't be ignored to change course.
And you touched on it a little bit. I just got to wonder what Xi Jinping has on his mind over there in China as he watches the sort of shining beacon on the hill get dimmer and dimmer by day, right?
It's an interesting question. And in some ways, this is a moment that really plays to China's advantage. The United States is the global economic engine leader. China's a close second. And right now, countries around the world, and particularly throughout the Pacific Rim and into Southeast and East Asia, are all going to have to be looking at, do we continue to rely on the United States that has been this security partner, economic partner, given how unpredictable and how economically aggressive it now seems to be. We can no longer count on access to this market. We can no longer count on this investment going forward. It is subject to continual threat and revision. China looks pretty predictable. It is not a democracy. It is clearly undertaking activities against some portions of its population that are in violation of human rights and so on. So it's not an easy choice to make. But if the choice is between economic punishment or a kind of economic stability that China offers, that would seem to for some states be a choice that is easy to make. And so I would think that to some extent China is looking at this as a moment of opportunity to solidify its position in the world as an alternative economic pillar for at least that region of the world. But at the same time, China's own prosperity depends on the United States as well, and so they're going to feel considerable disquiet, I'm sure, at what's going on. And so we see the economic tariffs there being used to try to push back against American pressure.
Dr. Stuart Prest, where can people find you if they want to learn more and interact with you perhaps online?
I am online most often at Blue Sky these days, at stuartprest.ca, I think is my handle. And I am also on a variety of media doing interviews like this. I'm honestly not that hard to find these days. Oh, I have a Substack too, so you can find stuartprest.substack.com or words to that effect. And so I try to post the things I do in the world there on a regular basis.
A special thank you to Dr. Stuart Prest for his time, and I've posted the rest of that conversation. We talk about a range of other topics within the realm of poli-sci. That's posted to sovereigncanada.fyi in the blog section. Thank you to Dr. Maria Popova, Nasser Nabahat, David Potter, and to you for listening. Sovereign Canada is created, written, and produced by me, Mike McCullough. The theme music is also my doing. Want to get in touch? You can email me, mike@sovereigncanada.fyi. And I'm also on Blue Sky. Follow vancitymike.com. Until next time.